Our first matter is Tyrone Huggins versus Mary Aquilar and others. May we please have appearances of counsel.
Selena Ellis, Walsh Pitsey, O'Reilly Falanga for third party defendant, Federal Insurance Company. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Mallon, Jason Lamparello, Mallon and Capuzzo on behalf of defendant, respondent, and third party plaintiff, New Jersey Manufacturers Insurance Company.
Good morning, Your Honors. Joseph Siclari from the Law Office of Patrick Patel, appearing on behalf of the plaintiff, Tyrone Huggins.
Good morning, counsel, and welcome. Ms. Ellis, please go ahead.
May it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please.
That's fine.
Third-party defendant, Federal Insurance Company, is seeking reversal of the trial court's grant of summary judgment to defendant NJM and denial of summary judgment to Federal. The trial court erred by finding that the valid step-down provision in Federal's garage policy was an illegal escape clause, and that defendant Aquilar was entitled to the full policy limit of $1 million. In doing so, the trial court sought to punish Federal because Federal had reportedly been on notice for 20 years that its step-down provision was unlawful, even though at least five judges of the appellate division have recently ruled that a step-down provision identical to that in Federal's policy is valid and enforceable in the same context. Federal requests that this court apply its opinion, Aubrey versus Harleysville Insurance Companies, to this case and hold, as it did there, that the step-down provision in Federal's policy is valid and enforceable. In the event that this court disagrees, Federal asks that this court reverse the trial court and instead find that the policy should be reformed to the statutory mandatory minimum of $15,000 in NJSA 39:6B-1A. Finally, while the trial court did not reach this issue because it refused to reform the policy in any meaningful way, Federal further maintains that the $100,000 minimum set forth in the MVC regulations NJAC 13:21-15.2L does not apply here because it was improperly promulgated by the Commissioner of Motor Vehicles. Thank you, and I'm available to answer any questions that the court may have.
Ms. Ellis, if I may, this is a UIM case, underinsured motors, is it not?
It's actually for liability coverage.
But they're seeking underinsured motors.
They are seeking. The plaintiff is seeking UIM.
Right.
Exactly.
Okay. And Aubrey dealt with UIM as in this case. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And the policy language, as I read it, in both policies, nearly identical.
That is correct, Your Honor.
And I guess the distinction between UM and UIM is that UM is mandatory. UIM is by choice. So therefore, the coverage, according to Aubrey, goes with the insured, not with the vehicle. And in that case, that policy was found to be a legal step-down clause, not an escape clause. The policy here is identical or nearly identical, and it's the same UIM. There's no distinction. Why shouldn't we follow Aubrey on this case?
Your Honor, I believe that we should follow Aubrey in this case. Aubrey examined the same policy, And it deemed that provision to be valid. It was in a slightly different context in Aubrey, but nevertheless, the court in Aubrey had to examine this exact step-down provision and deem it to be valid in order to complete the analysis in Aubrey.
This provision is in the limitation on liability, unlike Aubrey. So this provision seems to me to be rather indistinguishable from the situation dealt with in Rao, the Rao case, which you're familiar with, where it was viewed as an impermissible escape clause. And similar to what I wrote about in my dissent to the dismissal of the appeal in Ingrassia. So I think there is a significant difference between this case and Aubrey that perhaps is not being recognized in your argument. Can you address that?
I don't think that there's a significant difference between the situation here and the situation in Aubrey, because the Aubrey court specifically had to examine this exact same provision and deem it valid. And so the other courts, the appellate division, has been following Aubrey. And there's really no reason to be distinguishing the two cases. Sure, the coverage is different, but nevertheless, in Aubrey, the court had to evaluate the liability coverage provision and deem it valid.
But the net result of your argument is that the dealership here, which has a responsibility through the federal policy of ensuring this car that they have put on the road, is escaping its liability obligation through an escape provision by declaring a class of individuals not covered. It goes to the permissive user analysis, not a reduction in coverage, because of the way in which this policy is structured. That's the same argument that your adversary made in Ingracia, and it's the same argument that was being identified in Rao, that there is a significant difference because of where the clause is placed.
First, I disagree that it's an escape clause. It's a valid step down provision because it doesn't step down to zero. It steps down to the customer's insurance policy. It's effectively meant to be a safety net to ensure that there is coverage for the vehicle in every circumstance.
You're shifting coverage to a different company. You have escaped, your client is escaping liability when it has an obligation to provide coverage for the vehicle it has placed on the road.
The client isn't escaping liability. The client is the Trend and the insurer are ensuring that there is coverage for the vehicle. It's just a question of whether there's going to be complete coverage under the Trend policy, or whether in the circumstance where there's a customer who has their own insurance policy, the coverage is going to shift to that insurance. No matter, and just to be clear, there is a contract between the customer and the dealership that indicates that the customer must have their own insurance. So the customer knows going in that that's the circumstance.
Let's break this. I don't see this as an underinsured case, Ms. Ellis. So I want to break this down to make certain I'm understanding this case correctly. Huggins is the plaintiff, correct?
Yes.
Huggins is the victim, correct?
Yes.
Aguilar was driving the car. She's a tortfeasor, correct?
Yes.
Aguilar has her own insurance company, correct?
Yes. Insurance.
She has compulsory liability insurance that she's required to carry under the law, correct?
Yes.
The dealership has its own compulsory insurance liability, correct?
Yes.
Okay. She is attempting not to secure underinsured insurance. She's seeking to secure liability insurance that both her own automobile insurance, her own car is carrying, and also the dealership is carrying, correct?
Yes.
And she's suing both. She's suing her car had to have compulsory insurance, correct?
Yes.
And the dealership had to have compulsory insurance, correct?
Yes.
And the purpose of the compulsory insurance laws is to protect the victim. The victim. The victim here is Huggins. That's the reason why the dealership and her car has to carry liability insurance, correct?
Correct. And
so,
this,
so the question is, as a matter of public policy, and this is what Rao was discussing, she's entitled, Rao, which was approved by Aubrey, said that she is permitted to collect under both liability insurance policies. Am I not correct?
Well, first, Rao is not binding on this court, but nevertheless, I understand the point that you're making.
But I know it's not binding, but it was approved by Aubrey. The last paragraph of Aubrey talks about Rao approvingly, correct?
Well, it talks about Rao in a specific context. It doesn't approve the entire decision. Nevertheless, And I acknowledge that in Rao there was double dipping, but in Aubrey, the court does not state that double dipping should be allowed there.
Aubrey was, and this is what Justice Fernandez Vina was questioning you about. Aubrey was a case of underinsured. And Justice Pollack said, okay, underinsured is personal to you. And he distinguished that from compulsory liability that is carried by the vehicle. That was the difference he made. Okay, the compulsory liability insurance follows each of the vehicle, okay? And we have two vehicles here. She's covered under her vehicle and she's covered under the dealership vehicle. So I don't see how Aubrey is even relevant to this. That's underinsured, this is compulsory liability.
Well, Aubrey is relevant because there the court examined this provision and didn't deem it to be an escape clause, even though Aubrey asked the court essentially to deem the liability provision as invalid. And the court chose not to do so. And in order to do the analysis in Aubrey, the court had to review the liability coverage provision. And at no point did the court say, this is an illegal escape clause, we can't examine this. They examined it and then they completed the analysis. It's not dicta. It was
examined it for the purposes of first party coverage, not for third party liability coverage. So the analysis that the court was engaging in Aubrey was for an entirely distinct public policy.
It was for a different kind of coverage. Yes, Your Honor.
Correct.
Ms. Ellis, going back to your very first response to the question you got, how is this a UIM case?
Well, I think that it's not necessarily. The question here is who is going to provide coverage so that the plaintiff is made whole, right? So NJM is positing that even though the plaintiff has $100,000 worth of coverage, that instead the plaintiff should be able to collect ultimately from Aquilar, who is getting coverage from the garage policy. So there is a shift happening here.
If we broke this down just very simply. The dealership has a compulsory liability, right? Aguilar was a permissive user. Okay. They have to cover her. They are required to cover her. They have an insurance policy, I think, of what, a million? Is it a million or 750?
It's a million, Your Honor.
Okay. So a million. So the escape clause is permissive user, $1 million of compulsory liability insurance, and voila, through their contract, they don't have to pay anything. If that's like a magician. That's a complete escape, no? In plain and simple terms.
Your Honor, it's not a complete escape because in this state, there are a insurance policy is allowed to have step down coverage. You don't have to go to the mandatory maximum, the mandatory limit of the policy. And here there's a step down provision that says that for customers, there can be a lower level of coverage. And
what's the step down? They're paying zero. They're not stepping up anything.
In this particular circumstance, there's a step down to Aquilar's own insurance. But if Aquilar didn't have coverage or if her policy was deemed void, then of course the Trend policy would step in to cover the circumstances.
What is the definition of step down? Is a policy provision a step down provision if it shifts, if it not only reduces the liability to let's say the maximum, the minimum required by law, but shifts the burden of that liability or paying the insured to a different insurance company? You see the distinction I'm talking about? I mean, it would clearly be a step down if a provision said for a particular category of individuals, the only coverage you will receive is $15,000 in accordance with the statutory minimum, whatever. That's and we will pay that, but we're only paying that. That's a step down. If the provision does not, it essentially provides that the insurance company whose policy it is pays zero, but another insurance company is paying 15 or 30 or whatever it may be, is that truly a step down?
Federal posits that it is, because there's not step down to zero. There's still step down to coverage.
But it's the it's step down to zero for the for federal. And I'm just wondering because the step down cases typically involve provisions where the policy says, and it could be, you know, so it could be a pedestrian, a number of different settings that it could happen, where it says you're limited to this statutory minimum, 15,000, whatever it may be. Some of the older cases, it was lower. So that, but that's still the company, the insurance company whose policy it is still paying that $15,000. So what I'm asking is it still a step down? It's really a matter of terminology. If it shifts that insurer's obligation to zero and says, well, this other insurance company, which also insures you, has to pay to that statutory minimum.
Your Honor, Federal's position is that it continues to be a step-down policy.
Counsel, can you help us understand how your client gets below the $100,000 threshold? We have a statute, Title 39, 10-19, which empowers the Motor Vehicle Commissioner to promulgate regulations for a dealer's license. The regulation that you cited earlier, 1321-15-2, does just that and imposes the $100,000 per person per incident threshold. Why isn't the dealer obligated to provide that level of coverage in a case like this?
Well, first, the enabling statute purportedly undergirding NJAC 13:21-15.2L does not cede the right to the MVC to promulgate a regulation amending NJSA 6B-1's statutory mandatory minimum insurance coverage. Furthermore, the regulation doesn't specify that there can't be...
I'm sorry, could you explain that? Doesn't Title 39-1019 authorize the Motor Vehicle Commissioner to do what happened here?
It doesn't enable the MVC to make insurance decisions. That is the legislature has given that responsibility to the Department of Banking and Insurance.
What does the end of the first paragraph authorize then?
The end of the first paragraph of which?
This is about motor vehicle regulations, and it sets forth, it empowers the commissioner to take certain steps. And then the commissioner did so.
It doesn't empower the commissioner to make insurance decisions. I understand that it empowers the commissioner to make certain licensing decisions for dealerships, but it doesn't necessarily give the commissioner the ability to make insurance decisions. That is Dobie's responsibility.
So your argument is that Section 15.2, the reg, should be scrapped, given no weight at all?
Well, it's not that it should be scrapped. It's just that it should be read in conjunction with the regulation, the statute requiring mandatory minimum insurance of $15,000. The two can be read together, because while the dealership is required to have $100,000 worth of insurance, nowhere in the regulation is there any discussion about whether there can be any limitations to that coverage. And generally, if this were an insurance regulation, there would probably be a lot more detail around that. And that's Dobie's responsibility. They acknowledge that when there's $100,000 worth of coverage, there are all sorts of limitations that may come along with that. And even a certificate of insurance, when it is submitted to the MVC or the dealership, specifies that it's subject to the terms and the conditions of the policy.
So you were trying to explain to us the import of Title 39 and the regulation.
Yes, Your Honor. So the legislature did not specifically delegate insurance matters to the Motor Vehicle Commission. And when you look at the enabling statute, it pertains to the business of buying, selling, or dealing in motor vehicles. And sure, that is what the MVC is entitled to do, and they issue licenses to that effect. But Dobie are specialists in insurance, which is why the legislature has enabled them to deal with insurance matters. If the legislature here wants the $100,000 minimum coverage, then it's the legislature's job to make that clear. But there's no reason why the statute, the $15,000 minimum statute and the $100,000 regulation can't work in conjunction with one another.
Do you agree that the commission, when it adopted the regulation and went through the notice and comment period, made clear in response to a question addressing the very subject that you're addressing now, that it did mean to require the higher limits and had policy reasons for doing so?
Well, it said that it acknowledged that there is a $100,000 limit, but it never said that there couldn't be any limitations on that limit, that there couldn't be any step down to that limit.
In 2006, when they were responding to comments, they specifically said that they were rejecting the 1530 limits of 39 6A-1 and 6B-2 in their response to an argument that it should be kept at that level. How do you respond to that?
I respond to that by saying that the MVC is not DOBE and that they are not charged with dealing with insurance decisions in this state. And in the event that DOBE or the legislature chooses to go that route, it's their responsibility to do it and not the MVC.
And the very issue of their authority came up during the comment period as well. And the MVC said, in words to this effect, we have the authority here. You're saying they were flat out wrong.
I'm saying that it's the legislature's decision to determine whether the MVC has the authority there, not the MVC.
Right. So you're saying that MVC had no authority to adopt the regulation relating to insurance. Is that your position?
With the specific position, the specific portion relating to insurance, yes, Your Honor.
Did you challenge the reg?
No, Your Honor.
Challenge the reg?
My understanding.
And yet your client is writing a policy and asking for premiums based upon the assumption that the reg is satisfied by this policy written for this dealership, correct?
Well, Your Honor, there's the Federal's position is that the regulation is satisfied because Federal has over $100,000 worth of insurance.
What about Title 39 or DOBE's enabling legislation prevents the Department of Motor Vehicles from setting liability limits? In other words, where in the statute or DOBE's enabling legislation does it preclude other agencies of the state from setting liability limits with respect to motor vehicles?
It doesn't specifically preclude, but the legislature enables DOBE to handle insurance issues. So presumably that is their domain.
Okay, but it doesn't, that is their responsibility with respect to policies of insurance and banking. But it doesn't specifically limit other agencies, other statutorily enabled entities from requiring insurance, not necessarily with respect to motor vehicles, but with respect to property liability or environmental damage or whatever. I mean, all the regulations that require limits of liability for all kinds of things, not provided for specifically by the legislature and given to DOBE, they're all invalid?
It's hard to answer that question sort of in a, you know, because I obviously don't have every regulation and every statute in front of me. And there are probably circumstances where the legislature has deemed that other, that there can be regulations that deal with insurance in other contexts, but here that doesn't exist.
And
it's really up to the legislature to decide. That's Federal's position.
I have one other question, I guess, and I'm not sure, it may be overly simplistic, but I guess it's your position that as long as the innocent injured victim of an auto accident is provided with the minimum coverages, is provided with the minimum recovery as established by the legislature, then it is not an escape clause it is a step down, regardless of who provides that minimum mandatory.
In this particular policy, yes.
Well, wouldn't that apply? Okay, I understand your limitation. That's all we're considering is this policy, but yeah. It seems to me that would be a general rule.
Well, I think it really depends, because here there's a contract here. And so the expectations of the people that were involved are such that they acknowledge that the customer would have its own insurance, and that if it didn't have its own insurance, that then there would be a step down to, then there would be coverage under the trend policy.
And as long as that minimum coverage.
Yes. And
notwithstanding what the coverage of the dealership is, as long as that minimum coverage, for example, if the driver had no, she said, sign the contract, I have coverage. And she had not. She had zero. They would kick in the 1530. As long as there is the minimum liability coverage provided for by the legislature, then it is not an escape clause. Even if the insurance company trend pays nothing, it's not an escape clause. It's a valid step down.
Because the goal, the public policy goal, is to ensure that the victim always has coverage. And
at least
the legislature has said that the mandatory minimum coverage is 1530. And so if there's that minimum coverage, then yes, there should, then it would be a valid provision. So and it satisfies the public.
Do you challenge then the whole body of case law that says that you can't cut out certain permissive users if you have responsibility for insuring a vehicle that you place on the roads? I'm trying to understand how far your argument goes in this shifting of responsibility for third-party liability insurance of victims.
I think you can distinguish those cases by in circumstances when there is a contract and when there isn't. So in a circumstance like this, where the expectations of the parties, where the expectations of the garage and the expectations of the customer align.
Should you be looking at the expectation of the customer or the expectation of the innocent victim? Suppose this was a pedestrian who had been struck, or, you know, we happen to have somebody who was in another vehicle. I thought the public policy of compulsory insurance is to ensure coverage of the vehicle by the party who is responsible for putting that vehicle on the road.
Either way, under this scheme, the victim is protected. There's always coverage for the victim.
It's
under the statute.
I know, I feel like I'm beating a drum. To me, that is the equivalent of an escape clause to shift that responsibility over. Can I just come back to a follow-up question to something Justice Solomon was questioning you about? Because I did do a quick examination about other regulations that impose liability obligations higher than your 1530. And contractors with winning bids for municipal solid waste collection, okay, the big trucks that pick up our garbage, those contractors have to obtain automobile liability insurance in the amount of $500,000, $1 million pursuant to a regulation, 7:26H-6.17. And public movers also are subjected to a regulation that requires bodily injury coverage for their vehicles in excess of the limits, $25,100. So we do have numerous examples of higher compulsory insurance requirements for vehicles in liability settings. And I'm concerned that the import of your argument vis-a-vis this regulation could impact these other settings. Do you have anything to say about that that would provide some reassurance against that?
Well, I think it would really depend on the regulatory schemes that those settings come into play, Your Honor. I think it would depend on what kind of authority they had from the legislature, how it was promulgated. It's hard to answer the question without having examined each of those regulations.
Ms. Ellis,
Justice Levesque.
Ms. Ellis, I'm sorry.
No, that's all right. Let me just, this is a very short question. Justice Slovecchia asked you about, isn't the permissive user here being cut out of coverage under the step down? I think that's kind of what the question was. That's not what we allow. Do you have a retort to that? Is the permissive user in this case cut out of coverage for the innocent and injured victim?
I think it really, in this particular scenario, there would be a step down to the customer's own insurance. Nevertheless, there are many circumstances in which there would be coverage for the permissive user.
No, I guess your answer is that you're not cut out, you're getting the 1530.
Absolutely, Your Honor. At no point is there zero coverage. And I think that that's a really important distinction. At no point if the goal is to protect the victim, at no point is the victim unprotected. There will always be coverage for the victim.
Your argument is the same, even though the carrier in this case, who has coverage pursuant to a regulation, forget valid invalid for a minute, is not paying anything.
In this particular circumstance, but there would be many other circumstances where the carrier would be paying under this policy.
Yeah, up to 1530.
Up to 1530.
Not above that.
Not above that, according to Federal's interpretation of the statute.
Ms. Ellis, I just want to go back to your argument that you made in your brief and you've made today that Aquilar's reasonable expectation was that she wasn't going to be covered based on the agreement, that the loaner agreement. Are you relying on precedent, some sort of precedent to suggest that the permissive user's expectations factor into this court's determination of whether the provision was an unlawful escape clause?
You know, usually the permissive user doctrine comes into play when there is no contract between the parties, right? It's usually in the context of, I lend my car to a friend or I lend my car to a family member. But that's a different context here, because here, there was never any concern that the customer would not have coverage. Whereas if you lend your car to a friend or a family member, you don't know if they have insurance. You don't know if there's definitely going to be coverage for the victim.
Whereas right, here, but what I'm asking is, what relevance is it, whatever the expectation was, as to whether we did make a determination whether this is an unlawful escape clause. Again, thinking about the public policy angle here, the protection of the victim is important. The victim wasn't a party to this agreement. We don't know so the victim didn't have any expectations with regard to how much coverage he would get in this scenario. So what relevance do their reasonable expectations based on this policy have to whether this is actually an unlawful escape clause?
Well, the expectation of a victim in this state is going to be that the mandatory statutory minimum of $15,000 applies, because that's what the legislature requires. And here, that's guaranteed.
I have one simple question. I just want to, are you saying that under the law, the dealership is bound only by the 1530? All they have to do is issue 1530 and they're covered? That's what you're claiming. Because if you're saying that the regulation doesn't apply, then I'm assuming you're saying that the dealership has a requirement of only insuring each vehicle up to $15,000. Is that what you're saying?
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Well, then tell me what a dealership is required to insure its vehicles for.
The dealership is required under the MVC, they're required to show $100,000 worth of coverage in order to get their MVC.
You said that regulation is void ab initio because the enabling, right? So assume that's off the table. You're telling us, forget about the 100,000, aren't you? Are you not telling us that?
Well, I'm telling you, you don't need to get rid of the 100,000, okay. That there can be a valid step down.
I want to accept your argument as true. You're arguing to us that regulation is not any good, correct?
What I'm saying is they can be read in conjunction with each other.
Well, answer my question. Are you arguing to us the regulation is invalid?
What I'm arguing is that even though the regulation requires $100,000 worth of coverage, it does not necessarily say that you cannot drop down to the—
That's not, you're not answering my question. My question to you is, are you arguing to us that the regulation is invalid? That seemed to be your response to the Chief Justice's questions and to the questions of other members of the court, that it was invalid, that the enabling statute did not empower the motor vehicle agency of setting $100,000. So I want to be clear about this. Are you arguing that it's invalid?
I'm arguing that it's the legislature who should be determining where the legislature should be determining whether the 1530 applies. I understand that it's hard for me to answer your question, because my position is that you can have the $100,000 worth of coverage and also have a step down for customers that brings it to 1530 so that the statutory mandatory minimum is satisfied.
I just don't understand your dancing around the question of whether or not the regulation is invalid. That seemed to be your response, but you don't want to say it directly, because the alternative is that the dealership only has an obligation of insuring its vehicles for 1530.
Even if the dealership only had an obligation of insuring its vehicles to 1530, it would still satisfy the public policy expectations of having every car on the road have the mandatory minimum coverage.
Does it really matter whether it's valid? I'm sorry. Go ahead, Chief. Does it really matter whether it's valid or invalid? The fact of the matter is, they had a $100,000 policy, so it's a non-issue here. The issue is, can they reduce to 15? So does it really matter whether the policy is valid or invalid for purpose of today?
No, it doesn't, Justice.
Does it matter in this sense? If the MVC commissioner had the authority to impose an insurance requirement, a higher limit, that's the public policy of the state that needs to be followed. No?
There could be a higher limit and still be a step down provision. Just because there's a higher limit doesn't mean that there couldn't be any limitations on that.
So if we don't accept your argument that this is a valid step down provision, then does the 100,000 kick in or not?
Yes.
And when does the 100,000 kick in with respect? For example, an employee of the dealership is driving the vehicle. Is that $100,000 applicable?
Well, the employee, an employee of the dealership is covered under a different portion of the policy.
Separate, is that the $1 million limit or the $100,000 limit?
I believe it's the $1 million limit.
When does, forget the permissive user customer, when, if ever, does the $100,000 limit kick in?
Well, it wouldn't need to necessarily kick in, because there's—
Is it a fiction that they're paying a premium for this insurance that they don't ever have to use?
Well, they have $1 million worth of coverage.
But there's a $100,000 limit for liability resulting from a motor vehicle accident, correct? Per person,
where,
per occurrence.
Where a customer is driving the vehicle.
Only a customer. When does that $100,000 ever kick in?
It would kick in if the customer didn't have their own insurance. I'll give you an example, Your Honor.
30, it's not 100.
Well, I'll give you an example, Your Honor. So it's up for, our federal's position is that it should be the 1530. And if this court disagrees, then it should be the 100, but it should never be
the million. What is the 100 based on? Where does the $100,000 number come from?
Well, the $100,000 number comes from the regulation, if this court deems the regulation to be valid.
But you never have to cover anybody for $100,000 worth of liability insurance as a result of a motor vehicle accident involving one of your vehicles. Never.
It I'm does. Not sure.
This only applies to customers.
Understood.
Employees, 100,000, do they not?
Yeah. Well, there's a $1 million limit for this policy. It's just that there's a step down provision that limits it for customers.
Only as to customers, sense. Not as to employees.
Right, which makes sense because customers are an unknown quantity for a garage, correct?
Doesn't that support the public policy of asking for higher liability coverage? I mean, you're putting people you don't know in unfamiliar vehicles on the road. So Motor Vehicle Commission thought that was particularly dangerous and in need of higher levels of liability coverage. So why wouldn't the full million kick in?
Because in this state, there's allowed to be step-down provisions in policies. And specifically, the court has ruled in numerous instances where there is a reformation of a policy, where the court deems that a step-down provision doesn't apply, that the full policy limit shouldn't kick in. It should be the statutory mandatory minimum.
Has any step-down theory that you're espousing been applied to a third-party liability situation as opposed to a UIM? Can you name a single one?
Your Honor, I can't name a specific case, except that it has happened in the appellate division, applying Aubrey. Ingrassia and Culver in the appellate division applied Aubrey to the circumstances of this case.
Ingrassia.
What? I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry, Justice Patterson.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
I'm done.
You're done. Okay. Thank you. What is your argument for reformation for 100? And I understand your position is that the regulation's invalid. Assume it's not. What's your argument for reformation to $100,000 rather than the full $1 million?
This court has held in Proformance that when a provision is invalidated by the court, that the statutory mandatory minimum should kick in rather than the full policy limit. And in Protenzone, this court reaffirmed that position and held that the only circumstance in which you wouldn't do that is when you're trying to punish essentially trying to punish an insurance company for not changing its policy earlier because they should have been on notice that they had to. Here, there's no way the federal would have been on notice that its step-down provision was invalid, especially when the appellate division only recently has ruled twice, at least, that the exact provision is valid.
So your argument is that if your argument is not accepted on the regulation, then we should look at the law, which consists of statutes, but also consists of this regulation, if the court finds it to be valid, and find what is the mandatory minimum that the law requires, and that is $100,000 based on that regulation.
Yes, Your Honor. And
that's not your first argument, that's your backup argument.
Exactly, Your Honor. And that's the holding in Rao. That's what Justice LaVecchia recommended in the Ingrassia dissent. That's what Justice Wallace held in Proformance and in Protenzone.
In Rao, there was an excising of just the part that was found by the court to be an impermissible escape clause, and the remainder would apply. In this instance, why, if we found this to be an improper escape clause, why wouldn't the remainder of the policy be the $1 million amount?
Because in Proformance, the court specifically held that you go to the statutory mandatory minimum.
But we have still a valid contract remaining, the full $1 million.
Nevertheless, there was a step down provision, and so you don't invalidate the entire. You don't invalidate the intent of the parties. The intent was to step down to a lower coverage, and this is something that the Rao Court acknowledged also, is that when you have you have to sort of look to the expectation of the parties. A customer isn't expecting the full coverage, especially when they've already agreed that they're going to use their own insurance. So it would make sense that there would be a step down to the statutory mandatory minimum.
Is your position that in this case, and I know it's an alternative argument for you, that in this case, because of the confusion, the reformation should bring you down to the $100,000 limit? Or is your position that that would always be the situation, even if the court ruled against you, in the next series of cases, it should still drop down to 100,000.
No, it should be because of the confusion. Because as the court ruled in Potenzone, there had been something like 16 years worth of notice. There was no confusion there that a loading and unloading exclusion is unlawful. And so the fact that insurance companies continue to keep that clause within their policies was problematic. And they'd had years to change their rates, to change the language, and they had chosen not to. Whereas here, federal would not have been on notice based on the case law in this state over the last few years that there was anything wrong with the policy. The appellate division has consistently applied Aubrey to find that this specific language was valid. And so there hasn't been time for insurance companies like federal to take that into account, to see if they need to change their rates, to see if they need to change the language in order to effectuate the law.
Other questions, anyone?
I have one question. I have one question. I'm just trying to get the answer through because it makes sense to me, maybe not anybody else. Is the $100,000 coverage for a permissive user, like a customer, is there ever a circumstance where a customer is involved, a permissive user is involved in an accident with one of these cars, where that $100,000 kicks in? That $100,000 limit is ever kicks in, ever has to be paid, ever?
Well, if this court deems that there wouldn't be a step down.
Is there ever, currently as we sit, another drive, not somebody is using that car permissively and kills somebody, is there ever an instance when that 100,000 kicks in? Ever?
I think that there would be, yes.
When?
If the court deems that that policy, you know, if there's a declaratory ruling that
if we say it's an illegal step down,
yeah,
then is that what they were thinking when they got the 100,000? Is that why they have the step down? We'll never have to use it unless the court decides it's an illegal step down.
Ms. Ellison, I think what Justice Solomon is asking you is tell us your position and why.
Our position is that in the event that this court deems that the step down
Sorry. Don't tell us what we deem. Respond, please, to Justice Solomon's question. When does the 100,000 kick in and why, as you interpret the landscape?
Okay. So first, federal's position is that the $100,000 wouldn't initially kick in. The step down provision would result if the customer has insurance. The step down would result that the customer's insurance would kick in. However, if this clause is deemed to be a step down provision, if this clause is deemed to be an escape clause, then the mandatory statutory minimum should kick in. And that would be either the 1530 or the 100,000. In the event that it's the 100,000, that would be the circumstance where if there was an accident, that there would be coverage under the policy for $100,000.
And you're relying on the notice aspect of this because of inconsistency between opinions that have been, between decisions that have been rendered on similar issues.
Ms. Ellis, absent any ruling from this court, the 100,000 would never kick in. It would always be 1530.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that correct? And your argument is just about confusion. The 100,000 that Justice Allen talked about, it would never kick in absent some ruling from this court on this case. Is that correct?
Federal's position is that it should be the 1530 because that's the
statute. That's not what I asked you, ma'am. I asked you if the 100,000 would ever kick in as we sit today on any customer. I think the answer is no.
No, it would not.
Any other questions? Ms. Alice, we'll have you back for rebuttal unless there's something you'd like to add at this point.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Mallon.
Thank you, Your Honors. If it may please the court, to this court that Judge Militello, in reaching the decision that he did in this case at the trial level, followed the logic that two members of this court put forth in the dissent to the dismissal to Ingrassia 2 years ago. And that logic set forth by Justice LaVecchia in the Ingrassia dissenting opinion was that clause 3A, 2D of the federal policy is an invalid illegal escape clause. and not a step-down clause. And it is such because it eliminates coverage for an entire class of drivers, that being those customers with insurance of their own. A valid step-down would limit coverage. The clause that is purported to be a step-down in the federal policy eliminates coverage for those drivers entirely. And as such, is an illegal escape clause because federal completely avoids any liability to provide coverage for those individuals who are customers of Trend who are using their vehicle as a loaner. And as this court has previously held in decisions that Justice LaVecchia called polestars that should have been followed in Ingrassia, that being Willis and Rao, our state's laws on this issue have been clear for 50 years now that insurance policies cannot cut out permissive users of vehicles. We have the mandatory coverage requirements in New Jersey, and every owner has to provide coverage for the vehicle that they own. What federal attempts to do here is to have the driver provide that coverage, not the owner. And that is the fatal flaw in what they're attempting to do. There would have been a way to create a valid step down in their policy had it been done correctly, but it wasn't. They attempted to do it in their clause, which defines insured and then cuts out that entire class of folks who have their own insurance or are their customers in the definition of an insured versus trying to do a step down in the limits of insurance under the liability section of the policy. And a valid step down would have provided the mandatory minimum limits to that person that they were attempting to step down. It would not have cut out that person in its entirety, as was the case here with Ms. Aguilar. So in that respect, the clause that we're dealing with here is an illegal escape clause. And Judge Militello was correct in striking that clause. And in doing so, there's been repeated argument that he refused to reform the policy, and he didn't. He was very clear in his decision, especially on reconsideration, that he was not refusing to reform the policy. He, in fact, said he did reform the policy. He reformed it by striking the offending clause. What he did not want to do and should not have done was to rewrite the policy. And once that clause is stricken, it would have taken a complete rewrite of the policy to add in what may have been federal's intention to try to limit its coverage. And it was not the court's place to try to do that. Once that policy language was stricken, we're left with a clause that provides coverage for permissive users. Once Section D of 3A, 2D is stricken from the policy, then you're left with Section 2, which provides coverage for anyone else while using, with your permission, a covered auto. So in that respect, I submit that what Judge Militello did here was correct. It followed Justice LaVecchia and Justice Alvin's reasoning in the Ingrassia dissent to the dismissal and followed the thought of Justice LaVecchia's opinion about the flawed legal reasoning in the appellate division decisions of Ingrassia and Culver and attempted not to perpetuate that error, as was, I understand, Justice LaVecchia's goal in writing the opinion to that dissent. If there's anything in particular you'd like to ask me about, I'd be happy to discuss that.
Mr. Mallon?
Yes.
What would a legal step down clause say in this case? What would the language be that would make, you said that they should have written it in a way that would have been a proper step down clause. What would the language look like on that?
I think the language, and first of all, again, I don't think it should be under a definition of who's an insured. It should fall under the liability section of the policy. And oftentimes in that section of the policy,
absent what section is in, we understand the sections have different.
Right.
But what would the language look like that would create a step down clause in this case that you would think would be valid?
So I think the language would say something to the effect of if the individual using the vehicle is a customer, then the maximum amount of liability coverage that would be provided under the policy is the minimum limits required under the state law. Something to that effect.
That sounds like the language that was in this policy, doesn't it?
No,
because it was in a different section, but that sounds like a language, right?
Well, the language in this policy.
Provided coverage if you have the minimum. If you don't have the minimum.
Difference here is that in this policy, they say there is no coverage for your customers. That they start with no coverage for customers. They then add back in coverage for customers that don't have their own policy or who have policies that are less than the jurisdictional minimum limits.
The specific would rule the overrule the general. So there is coverage, although they say initially there's no coverage for your customers. The specific language provides coverage for customers depending on what kind of coverage they have. That sounds a lot like the suggestion you gave to me, the language for a proper step-down clause. Sounds very similar.
And I would submit that it's not, because in this instance, Ms. Aguilar, for example, and probably many other customers who have their own policies that provide whatever the minimums are, and I suggest they are 100,000 for a dealer, any customer that has those minimums gets no coverage at all from federal, and thus the owner of the vehicle then escapes any responsibility to insure this vehicle. And we know under section NJSA 39.6B that every owner has to provide minimum jurisdictional limits on their vehicle. And then, you know, that's 15,000 for your average person and 100,000 for a dealer.
Respectfully, I don't see how that's much different from the language you gave me as an example of a valid step-down clause. Sound very close to me.
Well, I'll attempt to address that, Your Honor. A valid step-down clause would provide coverage for every user, every permissive user of a vehicle, and it would limit it for those people who are customers. This clause takes away all coverage for customers and then adds it back in for some, but in doing so, it leaves a whole class of individuals with no coverage at all through the dealer policy. Any customer that has their own coverage that equals the minimum, they get no coverage at all through the federal policy, and thus have been thus federal has escaped any liability to those folks, which has been repeatedly decided by
liability to the customer or liability to the injured victim.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, liability to the injured victor. But yes, that's the better way to say it.
Okay, because I want to understand your what you're calling a legal step down. Yeah. They can just limit their third-party liability coverage to the minimum required by law, which I think I heard you say in this instance is the 100,000 required by the Motor Vehicle Commission. So that's the bottom to which you're saying federal could have stepped down liability coverage to.
Right. Our position is the very minimum that federal would have to provide for every permissive user of one of their dealer vehicles would be the 100,000. And you're correct, Your Honor, to clarify, the liability is to the injured party. And when I talk about the driver, it's a responsibility to provide liability coverage for the benefit of that driver, for that liability to the injured party who that driver has caused an accident.
I take it your position also is that federal cannot fob off its responsibility to provide coverage under its policy, regardless of what Aguilar's policy may be. Federal has to provide insurance under its policy, correct?
That is correct.
So the victim here, the innocent victim, is entitled to whatever coverage she's able to, whatever damages she can secure under both policies. That's your position, correct?
That is correct.
Wouldn't that violate our anti-stacking cases to say you can't stack underinsured motors coverage? And would that mean that if she had 100,000, she would have entitled another 100,000 for 200 coverage? Doesn't that violate the anti-stacking cases?
Well, Your Honor, in a underinsured or uninsured motorist setting, I agree that it would. And the first question that was asked today during the argument was
until you filed the law, the third part, this began as an underinsured motorist case, did it not?
It was a UIM claim. There is a UIM component to this case, but that is not the issue before this court. The UIM is the claim against New Jersey manufacturers. That's how we're in the case. We are the personal insurer of Huggins. When Huggins ran into a $15,000 limit with Aguilar, he placed NJM on notice of a UIM claim. But the issue before this court is not the UIM coverage. There's no question that Huggins had a policy with NJM. No one's contesting that. The issue here is the liability coverage provided under the federal policy. And while I agree with Your Honor that there's anti-stacking for uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, that is not the case in liability coverage. In fact, the injured party here would get the benefit of both the Aguilar $15,000 policy and the federal, million-dollar policy.
We rule the way you seek for us to rule, NJM's off the hook for underinsured their insurance covers, aren't they? They don't have to pay any. You're off the hook.
Correct. There would be no trigger of the UIM coverage if there is at least $100,000 with federal and
you would escape a payment because federal will be on the hook for the payment.
I wouldn't.
And I don't mean under escape clause. And essentially, what I'm saying, you wouldn't have to pay.
I wouldn't say we escape because that sounds like what we're saying that federal is trying to do. I would say we would avoid a payment because there's no trigger for underinsured motorists if there's sufficient liability.
Mr. Mallon, implicit in your answers earlier is that the regulation is valid and the 100,000 coverage would apply. Can you comment directly on the discussion we had in the previous argument? MVC crafted this regulation, not Dobie. What's your position on its validity?
Sure. So we know that Dobie is responsible for insurance issues, and certainly there's a minimum jurisdictional limit of 15,000 for every owner in the state. But in this case, the legislator gave the Motor Vehicle Commission responsibility to promulgate regulations as to the dealerships, and the Motor Vehicle Commission, using that authority, did so. And specific in the statute was the fact that they could promulgate rules and regulations. There were no limits placed on that, and for reasons that are expressed in the legislative history that's set forth in Justice Lavecchia's Ingrassia decision, they decided that the dealer should have higher limits. They went through hearings on that. There were some objections raised. They recognized the objections, but still decided that this was the right course to follow. So I believe they have the authority. They did not infringe on Dobie's realm here by saying, hey, we're not going to require you to even have 15. What they did was they extended those requirements, and you know that there's a floor of 15,000, but it's not a ceiling, and they have the authority to require dealers to have higher limits. And there are other examples. I know Justice Lavecchia mentioned a few, but also ambulances have higher limits. And I think there was another one that we mentioned in our brief too. There are other industries that have to have higher limits pursuant to various rules and regulations that have been promulgated by statute or the administrative code.
Just so I can clarify one thing, you premise your contention that this is an illegal step down clause on the fact that the law requires for this dealership $100,000 in coverage. And if they're not covered for $100,000, if they exclude a class of drivers from that $100,000, that would be an illegal step down.
Yes, but I also would say the fact that they won't even provide the 15,000 makes it illegal.
That's my second question. If Ms. Aguilar had zero, she had no coverage, and they had to pay their 15, would that still be an illegal step down? They're paying 15 to uninsured operators, permissive users who have no insurance. Under this policy, they get the 1530 coverage, and they would have to pay it. Is that still an illegal step down, or is that something different?
That would be something different. I would still contend in that situation they should be providing 100 based on the administrative code. But yes, we know Ms. Aguilar had 15, but using your example that she had no coverage at all, and they then provided the minimum limits, whether that be 15 or 100, I suggest it's 100. Then it's not an illegal escape clause under that set of circumstances.
My concern is this. If your contention is they must provide 100,000 by law, and anything less than that to a class of drivers is an illegal step down, then it doesn't matter whether there's 1530 coverage by the driver or zero by the driver. It's still an illegal step down. That doesn't seem to be the answer that you just gave. In other words, they would be paying 1530 if Ms. Aquilar had zero. So they'd be paying something, but you're saying it would still be an illegal step down.
Well, it was applied in this case, Your Honor, which is they paid zero. They are pointing to their policy saying they own no coverage whatsoever.
So is that what makes it an illegal step down, that they're paying zero, or that 100,000 is required and they're not paying the 100,000 to this class of drivers?
I think as applied in this case by Federal, it's an illegal step down because, you know, there is a dispute that Federal raises about what the minimum jurisdictions are. They don't recognize the administrative code.
You're taking Federal's position. You're taking your position, New Jersey Manufacturers. I'm asking you, is it illegal because the 100,000 limit is required, or is it illegal because they're paying zero? In which case, it wouldn't be an illegal step down if the driver, permissive user, had zero. They'd be paying 15, so it wouldn't be an illegal step down. Which is it?
Okay. I think first we would have to agree on what the minimum jurisdictional limits are.
I'm asking you. You're saying right. It's 100,000?
I say it's 100,000 under the administrative code.
Okay. So if they don't pay 100,000, even though for zero insure policy they would pay 15, it's illegal. Escape clause, even though they own some cases, even if though they're paying 15, if they paid 100, it's still illegal. Is that your position? That's what Justice Sala's been asking you.
Right. No.
Do you have to pay $100,000 or otherwise it's an illegal escape clause?
Right. And
yes or no? It calls for a yes or no answer, counsel.
If they don't pay the jurisdictional limits, which I submit are $100,000, then and they point to their policy to reduce this to zero, then it is an illegal escape clause.
So if someone had zero and they would pay $15,000, that would still be an illegal escape clause under your understanding?
I think that would be a misinterpretation of what the minimum jurisdictional limits are by the person that decided to pay 15.
Would it be an illegal escape clause, even though they paid 15?
If they're relying upon their clause in the policy to try to pay 15, then yes. But I don't think that's not what they're trying to do here. They're trying to pay zero, and that's why this is an illegal escape clause.
I see a number of...
Hypothetical question. If they were paying 15 to someone who had zero under the terms of their policy, would it still be an illegal escape clause under your interpretation? Yes or no?
I don't think there would be any authority for them to pay just 15 under the law. So if
under
they're
the terms of their policy,
right?
If they paid the way I read the clause. If someone has zero on coverage, they will pay 1530. It would that still be an illegal escape clause under your understanding because their policy limits are 100,000. Even though that we'd be paying someone 15 to 15,000, so it wouldn't be a zero payment, would that still be an illegal escape clause under your interpretation?
If they are relying upon 3A2D to do so, to pay less than what is required under the law, then yes, it is
the law requires 15. The policy is 100. The law requires 15. So if they're paying someone who has zero coverage, 15, they're paying what the law requires. Would there still be an illegal escape clause under your own interpretation that you've given us of this language in the policy?
Well, if we forget for a moment I
want an answer to my question, counselor, yes or no. Under your interpretation, would it be an illegal escape clause or not if they paid the 15 that someone had zero?
If they were voluntarily paying 15, it would sound to me like they're not following their own policy. And if they're not applying their policy, then I guess.
Doesn't the policy say that if someone has no coverage, they will pay the minimum, which is 1530? So they would be following the terms of their policy.
But not the terms of the administrative code. So that would be an inconsistent.
Okay, so then the answer to my question would be yes. Even if they paid someone with zero under the terms of their policy 15, it would still be an illegal escape clause because it's not paying 100.
I, I, I think in order to answer that, Your Honor, I think I would need to know why they were willing to pay 15 and not the 100.
We're going to interpret policy, but they want to do what we read the language of the policy.
Yes.
Yeah. Under the language of the policy, without knowing what the underwriter was thinking or what the adjuster was thinking, would it be an illegal? Justice Sullivan's been asking this for 10 minutes, and now me 15, I think.
Okay. Well, if they were willing to ignore their own policy and voluntarily pay, then that would probably make the issue of the escape clause. I think it still is an illegal escape clause, but it sounds to me like they're not going to enforce that illegal escape clause then.
Well, I just have, I was perplexed why you weren't directly answering Justice Fernandez-Vina's question, because it seems to me, in his hypothetical, it might not be an escape clause, but under these facts, it is an escape clause. I mean, that's the way you would harmonize it. He's giving you a hypothetical where, you know, federal's got to kick up some money, but in your case, they don't have to kick up any money at all. Look, that's all I have to say.
That's correct.
Okay.
Any other questions, anyone? Mr. Mellon, anything you want to close on?
The only thing I'd like to mention, Your Honor, if I may, because it hasn't been addressed yet today, is you know, it's our contention that federal has to provide at least $100,000. The result that Judge Militello came to was that in fact federal is obligated to pay the full $1 million, and I think there's two bases that decision's correct. One is based on Podazone, is that the insurance industry is known for 30 years under Rao and 50 years under Willis, that these types of clauses are illegal. That's one basis. The other is the reformation that I discussed earlier, that you can't strike this language. And once that language is stricken, then the policy provides full coverage to a permissive driver. So that's it on that issue. Thank you for your time.
Understood. Thank you. Mr. Ciclari, you're next. To the extent you want to incorporate arguments we've already heard, please do so. And we had 2 minutes or so saved for rebuttal, so have at it. We'll see how far we get.
That's perfect, Judge. Thank you. I'm not going to belabor the point that Mr. Mallon has expounded on. I agree with him wholeheartedly, and I would incorporate a lot of the arguments and statements that Justice Lavecchia and Justice Albin have very rationally set forth in establishing that this is unequivocally an illegal escape clause. Frankly, if there was an intention of the policy to step the coverage down, then there would be language that would step the coverage down. But the language is clear and unambiguous. The language of the policy states that there is no coverage afforded to permissive users of the vehicles who maintain minimum liability coverage of their own. Period, end of story. It doesn't even seem to be a disputed point. The language of Federal's policy, paragraph 3A2D, states that there's no coverage. So to that end, I disagree with the characterization of it as a step down. It's not a step down. It's like calling your, you have quiet neighbors when you live next door to a cemetery. It's a euphemism because the coverage is illusory. It exists in name only. So to that end, we really cannot look to a lot of the cases that we have here under Rao, and especially under Aubrey, because in those cases, you had valid step-down provisions, and the question was, does it or does it not apply? In this instance, there is a flat-out exclusion. There's no even attempt to provide coverage for, in this case, Aguilar, the permissive user of the Trend-owned automobile. Now, the question or the initial permission rule, I think it does apply here, but I actually don't think that under the circumstances that this is even as attenuated as that, because when we think about the circumstances of who the intended users of these automobiles are, they are the customers that we can safely assume anecdotally based on our own experiences of having our own vehicle serviced or just our own common knowledge that if we have our vehicle serviced at a dealership, that they will provide to us a loaner vehicle to utilize while our car's in the shop. So in that instance, the federal policy, federal knows off the hop that the vehicles that they are being, that they are insuring are being driven by an unknown, unnamed class of individual, but we know that they are customers of Trend Motors. So to that end, they're not even really a permissive user. They're a named insured to that degree. We just don't know their actual names because we don't know the names of the customers in advance. So there really is a high standard of care that needs to be afforded to them in that situation because they are the exact people for whom these vehicles are intended to be utilized by. And Trend Motors is realizing an economic benefit off those individuals using their vehicles because clearly those people are having their vehicles serviced by Trend at a financial benefit to them. So that's really where the disconnect becomes here is that there needs to be coverage for these individuals. And what federal is attempting to do here is shift that burden from themselves onto the customer to cover them for liability while they are simultaneously recognizing a financial profit off the service side of their dealership. Judge Militello, I think, properly identified the Potenzone case in this matter as the guide as to how the proper remedy should be formulated. And that is to strike the offending provision, just as Mr. Mallon alluded to or stated explicitly, is that once we strike this provision, now we have a conforming policy that customers are permissive users. They're the intended users of the vehicle. They're the intended end users of the vehicle. Specifically in this case, Aguilar was the person for whom the vehicle was lent. There's no attenuation that she lent the vehicle to someone else. And there's no allegation that she was using the vehicle outside the scope of her permission to utilize that vehicle. So therefore, she is a covered individual with $1 million of coverage available. And on face value, again, that might seem somewhat punitive to federal, but I would disagree with that because just as in the Potenzone case, federal has been long on notice that these types of exclusionary clauses that exclude wide swaths of individuals who are permissive users under the policy, they have long been on notice that these types of exclusions are absolutely invalid. In fact, in Potenzone, the Penn National, the writer of the policy, acknowledged in their appeal that the policy language was unenforceable. And they actually dropped that aspect of their appeal before the appellate court and ultimately the Supreme Court, before the appellate court, I should say. So the only issue in Potenzone was to what limit should coverage be afforded. And at that point, the court said, look, you've known forever that this policy is invalid. You knew that, but you wrote it anyway. Federal in this case, and Penn National as well in that case, are in the business of writing insurance policies. It's incumbent on them, not the end user, and certainly not the injured victim, to ascertain whether or not the policy that they write is valid or invalid. And in theory, it should be incumbent on them to write a policy in good faith that's legally enforceable and congruent with state statutory scheme. But they didn't do that. Just as in this case, in Potenzone, the court stated specifically that you had X number of years, a long time, to do one of two things, to either A, adjust your premiums accordingly to the risk, or B, issue a rider that eliminates the invalid step-down provision to cure the deficiency. In Potenzone, just as in this case, the insurer did neither and instead fought the policy. And in this case, federal fights the policy even further, going all the way here to the Supreme Court, alleging that the policy is a step down when clearly it's an exclusion. And even in Potenzone, they dropped that aspect of the appeal. So the court stated that there has to be some skin in the game for the carrier to write a policy in good faith, Because going back to a point I believe Judge Solomon was making earlier, is that if Federal and insurers like Federal know that the court is going to come in and reform the policy to a state minimum, it doesn't matter what the upper limits of the policy are. They're never going to pay them. They know that if and when the policy is challenged and its validity is challenged, and it is ruled after years of litigation that the policy is indeed an illegal escape clause, that it's just simply going to be reformed to the state minimum. In fact, in this case, prior counsel for Federal on the record stated that, well, there might be a 15 policy. And frankly, it's that level of casual indifference to the outcome, knowing that the court may come in like a white knight and save them from themselves, that is the exact policy argument as to why Potenzone should be followed in this case. The court should come and slap the hand of Federal for knowingly or willfully ignoring the statutory scheme, writing an illegal escape clause, attempting to pass commercial liability off onto essentially a pedestrian, and leaving an innocent third-party victim uninsured. With that, Your Honors, I will take questions.
Any questions for counsel? Thank you for the succinct argument. Is there anything you wanted to close on, or?
That's
we really have your position.
That's good. My position.
Very good. Thank you. Ms. Ellis, brief rebuttal.
Thank you. Very briefly, a couple of points. First, coverage under the federal policy is not illusory. There are a number of scenarios in which coverage would apply. And I think Mr. Mallon pointed out, in effect, when it would apply. If there was no coverage, if Ms. Aquilar had no insurance, then the step down would effectuate and she would be entitled to $15,000 worth of coverage. And according to Mr. Mallon, that would not be an illegal escape clause. But here's where the incongruity comes into play. Because if Ms. Aquilar has no insurance, she gets $15,000 worth of coverage under the federal policy. But according to the trial court, because Ms. Aquilar did have insurance, she's now entitled to the $1 million policy limit. And that just makes no sense. Finally, Federal hasn't been on notice for 30 years or 50 years that its policy language is an illegal escape clause. Under Culver and Ingrassia, 2016, 2018, the appellate division specifically ruled that Aquilar applies and that these exact same clauses are valid in the same context. So there's no way that Federal is not playing games here. It was just following the law as it has been issued within this state very recently. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you to all counsel. We'll take the matter under advisement.